this is the Fanfic Podcast. We're doing an episode where we're selecting poetry and just discussing it.
We're going to be discussing four different poems. The Brain is Wider Than the Sky by Emily Dickinson. Darkness by Lord Byron. One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. And The Albatross by Charles Baudelaire. Big news for this episode is that we have new people. Their names are Fabrice, Rob, and Nina. As a reminder, my name is Daniel. Let's start with everyone introducing themselves.
Thank you, Dan. My name is Fabrice. I'm French-Canadian by birth. I now live in Philadelphia, where I teach. I studied philosophy, political philosophy, and I'm also in charge of a reading group.
Rob, go ahead.
Sure. My name is Rob Dean. I live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is about 20 miles north of the University of Iowa, my alma mater. For both my bachelor's and my MBA. I'm an operations manager for Amazon. I also have six kids between myself and my wife. So that's a little bit challenging too sometimes. They do keep our lives busy.
Okay, first I have to comment. That's incredible. I'll introduce myself. My name is Nina. I have a science and engineering background, and I've been working as a researcher in the biotech life sciences field. But I do like to offset the technical nature of my job by reading books in the meantime and, you know, thinking about the philosophical and sociological topics embedded in them. So, you know, I definitely don't have like the humanities-based academic background, but would hopefully be able to offer some, you know, different viewpoints on the works that we cover.
I'll say a little bit about myself. Once again, my name is Daniel. My background is that I work as an attorney doing commercial litigation. I'm originally from Chicago, but I've been living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan for the last 6 years with my husband. My background in the humanities is that in college, I majored in English and minored in philosophy, and I was really hardcore about it. I was actually planning to go to grad school before I thought better of it, went down the path I'm currently on of being a lawyer, for better or worse.
We each have one poem that we selected just based on our interests. We figured it'd be a good way to kind of introduce ourselves. The poem I chose was The Brain is Wider Than the Sky by Emily Dickinson. Basically, she is a 19th century poet who lived in Amherst, Massachusetts. Her prime years of poetic creativity were probably 1860 to 1865 or 1870. So, you know, basically at the same time as the Civil War. She came from a sort of Calvinist background, but it was also a time of rapid secularization. Her poetry is kind of a symptom of that, of trying to reconcile science with God and reason with God. I guess without further ado, this is the brain is wider than the sky. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease. And you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue. The one the other will absorb, as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound. And they will differ if they do, as syllable from sound. So the first stanza, the brain is wider than the sky, for put them side to side, the one the other will contain it with ease and you beside. It's basically using a geographic metaphor, I think, wider width. I think this is bringing to mind ideas of kind of geometry and logic. I mean, okay, obviously this poem is in some way about consciousness, sort of the power of consciousness. In the sense of consciousness ultimately is a thing that contains everything in existence, potentially. It seems like the possibilities of what the mind can potentially contain are just enormous. When I say contain, obviously the meaning is comprehend. You know, it can consider everything in the universe. The second stanza, I think, is getting at a different kind of thing. It's the brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. I don't think it's just she's repeating herself. I think she is trying to get at a different thing that the mind can potentially grasp. And it's something along the lines of meaning in the world, or mystery, or the motivation, or telos, or something. The brain, the metaphor of depth is traditionally taken as kind of referring us to some sort of, you know, meaning or mystery, as opposed to a more geographic metaphor of width.
So I have a question. Do you think it's interesting that she used the word the brain instead of the mind? Because I think you're using them interchangeably. And like the way that we would think about it, right, in the 21st century is quite interchangeable in a way. But I'm curious about, like, I don't know, from the historical perspective, you know, is she doing something intentional with kind of making it like an anatomical thing, like a human thing?
Yeah. It's pointedly not spirit, it's not soul, it's not mind, it's brain. Okay, there's a lot that we care about from religion, morals, etc., that doesn't translate very precisely into a scientific language. It's difficult to figure out like what to translate like the physical processes of the brain into the idea of like a person, right? And by using the word brain rather than mind, she's kind of highlighting this problem. If it was the mind, that would actually, that sounds quasi-mystical. And whereas the brain, it's like this stupid little object in your head.
Saying the brain actually draws the contrast, I think. The brain is, as you said, just this fragile little thing that contains everything that is and more. There's this huge contrast between the smallness and the frailty of the brain and what it can actually do.
Okay, second stanza, there's an idea of the brain comprehending sort of meaning in life, or you know, there's like this depth metaphor. And then we get to the third stanza. The third stanza is the one where it just gets very mysterious very quickly. All right, so just here it is one more time. The brain is just the weight of God for half of them. Pound for pound, they will differ if they do a syllable from sound. So let's just parse this a bit. Now, okay, we've just had width, geographic metaphor. We had depth, you know, which maybe is like a meaning kind of metaphor. Now we have weight. This sounds like it's evoking kind of mass. So it's like a different kind of measure. You know, mass and weight are kind of used not exactly interchangeable, but similar ideas in physics. Okay, so back to the poem. For heft them, obviously heft means weight. Was for weigh mm-hmm. them pound for pound, and they will differ if they do a syllable from sound. So there's two questions here. If they do. So there's a possibility that the brain, our stupid little organ, is the weight of God. Is God. It, right, is somehow consubstantial with God, right? That's one possibility. If they're not, then the difference would be the difference between a syllable and a sound. That's probably the most difficult line in the poem, right? As if a syllable from sound. I think what this is getting at is that a particular word or syllable can be viewed as a just purely a sound, like a sound wave, or it could be viewed as containing information. And she is saying that the difference between the brain and God would have to be this difference between the, you know, basically the sound, like the medium of sound of the wave, right? And the information that is being conveyed on it. And that then raises a question. You could have two potential readings here. Is the brain the thing that's analogous to the syllable? And God is the sound, which would be, I think, sort of like maybe a Spinoza-y kind of idea, which is God is a sort of underlying substance. You know, you could also maybe cite Berkeley, which is, you know, God kind of underlies human consciousness in some way. The other alternative, which I think is maybe a little bit more persuasive, is God is the syllable, i.e. it's sort of like the information being conveyed, and the brain is the sound. So we would be God's sort of instantiation in the world. This lines up well with ideas of, you know, the Gospel of John, you know, which begins with a statement that the Word became flesh. the beginning of Genesis, this idea of the spirit, breath, moving on the face of the water. You know, God is essentially forming reality through speaking, in a sense. It probably also connects to a tradition of poetic inspiration from the gods that you could probably trace from, you know, Plato to Milton and Emerson and any number of other things. So if one takes the second reading, it would be a sort of reversal then. So the brain, you know, first two stanzas are like, the brain is really great, contains everything. And the surprise at the end then would be, you know, the brain, it's about to say, like, the brain is maybe the same thing as God. But if it's not, then actually it's like a very different thing. It would be that God is in a way like just controlling or acting through consciousness. And I think that the dilemma she's pointing at is something along the lines of, like, what is the ultimate source for meaning in the universe? Like, if so, we're either saying it's sort of like our stupid brains, like, do you really think that? Or if not, then maybe it is God, but it would certainly be a strange God to be doing this.
I thought throughout the poem, there was a lot of dichotomy represented between the physical and the metaphysical world. but I think Dickinson was trying to exemplify that conflict between what is physical and what is seen in our world. We have empirical evidence, and then how that falls in line with the beautiful, mysterious, sacred things that cannot be measured in physical form.
Yeah, there's one thing that any school children knows who had like one class about religion, is that God is not supposed to weigh anything. I just find it very mysterious. The difference between syllable and sound, it's an important one. Not all sounds are syllables, but all syllables are sounds, so to speak. A syllable is part of a word that's something that is tied to some meaning, whereas a sound can have no meaning. And so that's, as Dan said, it's very hard to know which one is the syllable and which one is the sound. I would think that God cannot be a syllable. If God is anything, he has to be a complete. And a syllable, by definition, I mean, there are some one-syllable word, like God, for example. But a syllable, for me, when I think about a syllable, I'm thinking about part of a noun.
Part of the whole.
Yeah, part of the whole. Now, it's not always true, but that's what the first idea that comes to my mind, and I'm sure that I'm not the only one to think that way. And so I would think that she equates God and sound.
Let's wrap up our discussion of Emily Dickinson. Fabrice, you go next.
I've chosen a poem by a French poet. I'm talking, of course, I'm thinking about Charles Baudelaire. And the poem that I chose is The Albatross, which is a poem that Baudelaire, that one can find in Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil. The Flowers of Evil are a collection of poems. First edition was 1857. There were four editions of The Flowers of Evil. The Albatross was not included in the first edition. It was included in second edition, 1861. A few things that people should know about Baudelaire that are important to understand the poem is that Baudelaire was born in 1821, and 1821 is the year that Napoleon died. It's also, in France, a period that we call the Restoration. And so in France, it's the return of the kings. So they bring back Louis XVIII and Charles X. Then there's a small revolution, because Charles X was deemed to be too authoritarian. And he is replaced by Louis-Philippe Premier, that was called at the time the bourgeois king, sort of a constitutional king. Not very inspiring, kind of, it was not an interesting time to exist in France, because, that's how it was felt, and described by many, French writers, Balzac, Hugo, Baudelaire is one of them. It's depressing to be in France at that time, because people remember Napoleon. The Napoleonic time was a time of hope, of ambition. You know, everything was possible because Napoleon had proven so. But after Napoleon, then we're sort of back to the ancien regime, but not really. Sort of a twilight zone that's kind of depressing. And so Baudelaire was born into that time. Lost his father at the age of 7, if I remember. it's important because his mother remarried with this General Opic, who with whom Baudelaire will have a very difficult relationship. And when he was 18, he inherited from his dad who had passed away, and started to live the life of a young bachelor. And that did not, that was not well received by the General Opic, who decided to send Baudelaire on a trip around the world to put some distance between his stepson and Paris. And so Baudelaire is on that boat. And during that trip, he witnessed what he describes in that poem. That's why I wanted to mention that story. The Albatross is a people might not know that, but in the 19th century, that was the enemy of sailors. It is said that whenever there was a man would fall off the boat and would end up in the sea, albatross would actually attack those men because they thought that they were fish. I mean, who knows what, why they were doing it, but they were perceived as hostile animals. And so they were hunted or fished because sailors would throw in the ocean some fish on a hook and try to catch those albatross, and then they would bring it on the ship and kill it. And so it's an animal that at the time was perceived negatively by sailors. So that's enough, I think, for the context. I think I can jump in and read the poem. I'm going to read it in French first, and then I'll attempt to read it in English. L'albatros. Souvent pour s'amuser, les hommes d'équipage prennent des albatros, vastes oiseaux des mers, qui suivent, indolents compagnons de voyage, le navire glissant sur les gouffres amers. À peine les ont-ils déposés sur les planches que ces rois de l'azur maladroits et honteux laissent piteusement leurs grandes ailes blanches comme des avirons traînés à côté d'eux. Ce voyageur ailé, comme il est gauche et veule, lui n'a guère si beau qu'il est comique et laid. L'un agace son bec avec un brûle-gueule, l'autre mime en boitant l'infirme qui volait. Le poète est semblable au prince des nuées qui hante la tempête et se rit de l'archer. Exilé sur le sol au milieu des huées, ses ailes de géant l'empêchent de marcher. Now I'm gonna read it in English. The albatross. Often to amuse themselves, crewmates catch albatrosses, those vast seabirds who follow indolent fellow travelers, the ship gliding over the deep, briny sea. Scarcely have they placed them on the deck than these kings of the sky, clumsy, ashamed, pathetically let their great white wings drag beside them like oars. That winged voyageur, how weak and gauche, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, it means clumsy, he is. So beautiful before, how comic and ugly he is. One man worries his beak with a stubby clay pipe, another limps, mimicking the cripple who once flew. The poet resembles this prince of the clouds, who haunts the tempest and laughs at the bowmen. Exiled on the earth, the butt of hoots and jeers, his giant wings prevent him from walking. Beautiful poem. Everybody, I think, has understood that the albatross is the poet. And if we want to, I mean, there's a few symbols that are very easy to interpret. As the poet, the crew members as, now one could say the bourgeois, or maybe the art critiques. Baudelaire's work was not well received in his time. 1 month after its publication in 1857, Baudelaire was accused of, in French we say, corrompre les mœurs, of having written something that was dangerous for morality, public morality. And he was found guilty. He was a controversial figure in his time, and he was not well liked by, I would say, you know, the authorized public opinion. He certainly was not an enemy of religion, to the contrary. One big reproach that Baudelaire addresses to the bourgeois that were the dominant class at the time in France was that they do not care about religion anymore. They are, you know, they care about progress. They care about civilization. Words that for Baudelaire are basically lies, because Baudelaire, according to him, and that's the knowledge that he has that makes him appear so clumsy to his contemporaries. For Baudelaire, the main problem that we are confronted with is the deprivation of the human heart, the fallenness of man, and civilization can't do anything against that. And it actually makes it worse. And that language cannot be understood by the bourgeois. He is pessimistic about the possibility for human civilization, as it was understood in the 19th century, to do anything to help us. And that's the knowledge that he has. So and that makes him a little bit apart from the others. And so there's this pessimistic element in Baudelaire that is undeniable and very visible. The one that maybe is less visible is the ideal. Baudelaire wrote many poems about what he calls correspondences. You can find beauty in the world, even if it's fallen. And that beauty sort of echoes something else. It reminds us of something. The fact that we're that we can see it, that we can be moved by it, is a sign that there's something noble in us, that there's something that has quality. And that's a very important idea for Baudelaire, equally as important as the first one, that makes the albatross the prince of the sky. His task, the poet's task, is to be the guardian, the custodian of that ideal. He's the only one who remembers it. The bourgeois have forgotten about its existence. They don't care about it. They just care about making money. And so the poet has to be the vigil of that ideal, even if it makes him the scorn of society, which in Baudelaire's case was literally true. That's basically how that poem should be read, in my opinion. The poet as the vigil, who is higher than everybody else, and he is in the sky. When he's in the sky, he is in his element. The only problem is that he cannot live there. He has to sometimes eat and sleep, and therefore he has to interact with the non-poets, and that creates problems for him.
Okay, there's that line, "He who of late was so beautiful, how comical and ugly." Maybe there's an idea here that, like, the poet has to present himself as ugly, basically. That there is some sort of inversion of, you know, okay, maybe ideally I would be able to present a beautiful poetry, but realistically speaking, I'm presenting a ugly poetry. And you can kind of, I don't know the original, but in a way, and it sounds very musical, I would say. But in a way, it's an ugly poem. I don't mean that as a critique, but I think it just sounds like, okay, there's these guys, they're on a boat, they shot a bird, now they have their little, like, pet bird, and they're torturing it. Like, that's kind of
right.
A summary of the plot. It's not very pretty.
It's sadistic.
I kind of had the same feeling as you. I was thinking that it's quite, like, twisted, actually, because, you know, it's just talking about how, like, they don't kill the albatross, right? They just watch it, like, walk around all, like, deformed and crippled and stuff, right? And that's the pleasure that they take in it, which is, I don't know, like, kind of worse in a way. I don't know, like, because it's, like, miserable, right? You're, like, reveling in its misery, and it's, yeah, like, that seemed, like, a little bit more torturous, right? Because there's actually no, like, end, right? Like, it's not like they just, like, caught it and killed it, you know, and then end of story.
The albatross does not escape, and he's not killed either. It's just there being burnt by the clay pipe and kicked by the other sailor and mocked by the rest of the crew. And you can be sure that Baudelaire witnessed that during his trip. It's something that he saw. And once again, the idea of correspondences, it made him think, he saw in that the image of what he was about to become, which was an albatross. I was talking to a friend of mine about that, who is a poet. And I was telling him, yeah, Baudelaire thought that the poet was an albatross, and or Baudelaire compares himself to an albatross, and he corrected me and said, no, he compares the poet to an albatross, and real poets have to be a little bit that. If you are totally integrated and accepted by society, you're not a real poet, for Baudelaire at least, and maybe he's wrong, but that was certainly what he thought. Because the poet is the vigil of the ideal, and the ideal cannot be, by definition, accepted and seen by the majority. And therefore, the poet has to be on the outskirts of society. He has to be misunderstood, partially.
Why is it that beauty has such a hard time existing in the modern world, right? Like, that's kind of, why is it so bad, guys? Like, you know, what's so bad about GDP growth, people having consumer goods? You're pointing to like a larger problem here. He felt like the job of the poet was more or less to capture these little bits of beauty that are kind of, you could potentially still get at in an inverted way in like ugly poems. It's like this ironic ugly beauty thing. Why can't you write a beautiful thing anymore? What fell out of the world and made beauty impossible?
Probably like capitalism. You know, because if this is in the 1800s, right, like, you know, with the start of kind of more modern era, you know, innovation and growth and things like that. And I think people's minds are less turned to like what we have and appreciating what we have and like grow for growth's sake, turning away to new things, like more material things, not necessarily. Yeah. Like the natural beauty that we used to appreciate, you know, even animals and nature, like I don't even know, like, it was only because I went to a national park that I even know what an albatross is, you know, and, you know, we're so disconnected from it. Then it becomes less of a common idea that you can, you know, commune and talk to other people about. Yeah, it just kind of like falls by the wayside.
Once money becomes a potential object of desire, it takes the place of everything because you never have enough of it. Now, Baudelaire is not that simplistic. He would say that the problem is deeper than that. But let's say that the preoccupation with money that defines the bourgeois is one very visible manifestation of what separates the albatross from the others. There's also the problem that society needs certainty to function. We need to agree on a certain number of things to be able to live together. The poet knows that those certainties they're not that certain. They're not that obvious. And that what seems to be pretty is not that pretty. The people that are deemed to be morally decent might not be as morally decent as they seem to be at first glance. And the poet knows it. And Baudelaire certainly did irk a lot of people. The realism of his poems. He talks about a lot of things that nobody talked about. Talks about sex, of course, drugs, debauchery, going to the bathroom. He talks about all these things that were not deemed appropriate by civilized society of his time. There's an anecdote. Baudelaire was at that dinner with his father-in-law, le général Aupic. And at one point, the conversation takes an unfortunate turn. I don't know what they were talking about, but his book, and there were a lot of guests because the general pick was a somebody. And so Baudelaire, through him, was in contact with a lot of important people of French society. And so there were a lot of guests, guests of importance. Basically, his father-in-law slapped Baudelaire across the face because Baudelaire had said something or had done something that was inappropriate or that the general did not like. And Baudelaire just lost his mind. Just started to scream and shake, and he was like, he did not have a very good reaction to being slapped in the face in front of people. I mean, we can understand that, but he did not react with nobility. He reacted, I don't know, with a lot of clumsiness, and he did not slap him back or provoke him in a duel or something like that. He reacted a little bit like a child or like someone who cannot control his frustration. And when I think about the albatross, I think about that scene.
All right. That should wrap up our discussion of Baudelaire. Nina, let's have you go next.
So the poem I'm going to introduce is One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. So I'll start by reading it. One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these things will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last, or next to last, of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. First of all, I thought the title was kind of misleading because at first I thought, you know, maybe, you know, by referring to losing something as an art, you know, it's sort of like romanticizing. But then when I was thinking more about what she was actually trying to say, I thought it was a little bit more of a bit like stoicism, you know, which is just sort of like not having strong bonds to things, which usually makes separation or losing things a little bit easier, you know, if you don't form such an emotional attachment to things. And I thought it sort of appealed to rationality and was kind of like, you know, like a 12-step program to, you know, like losing things and getting over things, you know, like step one, lose small things like door keys and a watch, you know, and get over it, you know, and then step two, you know, kind of like losing houses and then like losing people. So a little bit of like rationality, kind of like a self-help guide. And, you know, just for me personally, I guess I thought I could relate to it because, you know, I moved a lot, you know, as I grew up and everything. So I was never really conditioned to take one person or place or thing, you know, too dear to me, you know, because, you know, it was, yeah, moving a lot.
Is the one art here something she's making fun of, or is the one heart art here something that she's endorsing?
Yeah, so I didn't know because I thought she was trying to be humorous about it, you know. She's not really actually like ambivalent about losing these things. It's actually really serious, but I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like almost a mocking tone at times. For example, the lines, even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. Shan't in American English is
shall not.
Allusion to British English, which is like an overly formal kind of British usage, right? Like if an American is trying to sound pretentious, they might say shan't, like especially if you're Elizabeth Bishop. And
she sounds like she's getting a little bit tough in the poem, little flex there,
right?
But in a funny way.
You know, just the general situation is sort of like a pretend advice. You know, it sounds like a piece of like pretend book of advice or something, or a how-to book.
It's obvious that speaking about the end and the inevitability of the end. And I think maybe she's also saying that people try to draw a pretty picture of the end when it's still the end. It's inevitable.
Right. There's this weird thing in the poem where it's like she's pretending she's accomplished something by losing it. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three houses went. Like, good for you. Right? It's a sort of, it's a strange sort of psychological trick she's playing on herself.
Or you think she's sort of like bragging about all the things that she's been able to like lose with like no consequence?
Because she has the ability to lose them without consequence, right?
That's true. I thought that, you know, it is a little bit pretentious because I was thinking like the invocations of like this hypermobile, well-traveled life that kind of can only really like appeal to a certain subset of people who might have.
I don't think it's actually pretentious, right? I think it's ironic. There's an ironic pretension, right? And what's the purpose of this irony, right? That would be the question. What's the purpose of this pose of, and then we have at the end, her interjecting into her poem, write it, like some sort of schoolmarm telling herself to write it.
Or like an inner voice, perhaps saying, write it, similar to some of the work by Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club and Choke and other books, a more bizarro genre, but he writes in his books, he writes like sometimes the voice of his consciousness.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, was that it was a weird sort of, it's almost like she's a like a Dr. Jekyll, yeah, Mr. Hyde kind of thing. And it's like, write it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And it's also like, you know, like, I don't know what, at what point, you know, in time that she's writing it. But yeah, this is like maybe one of those like hindsight type things, right? And reflecting in a different way than like when she initially experienced all these things, you know, could have been much more traumatic, like if she had written it then, you know. But now that like all these other things have like built on top of like smaller things, you know, maybe her perspective has also changed.
No, I agree with you that it had not struck me at first, but in the last stanza, the "I shan't have light" is clearly ironic because it breaks with the kind of language that she uses in the rest of the poem. It clearly stands out. It's overly formal, and so therefore it must have been ironic. I'm just noticing that the last two stanzas end in disaster. We go from one to the other: disaster, master, disaster, master, disaster, disaster. And I wonder if there is something to that. If she means something by it.
Like they, before they were split by like two other lines, but now like the disaster is creeping up on the mastery of the disaster.
And the
it's like disaster much is closer, winning.
And the fact that she says write it indicates that she did not want to write it. And so sort of something that's hard for her to admit, maybe an admission of something. So maybe there is less, maybe she's less, that art of losing is not as easy to master as she pretends it is. It's something that she has to say. It's something that maybe is helpful to think when she has actually lost something. But is it really true? I think that the last stanza sort of puts that back into question. And even the stanza right before that, and then I'll be done. She says, "I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster." So okay, it's not a disaster, but she misses them. So it's there's still something that loss still impacted her in a way.
I heard the irony there too that Daniel was referring to.
I mean, with regards to, so I mean, just to circle back to the irony thing, I kind of view the irony as having two potential readings. There's a sort of ambiguity, I think. I think one view is that you can view this poem as being an argument for the importance of grieving, i.e. the art of losing is just a bad idea and she's just making fun of it. The other reading, I think, is that the art of losing is a good thing, that it's a serious argument, like maybe presented in a funny way, maybe a self-deprecating way, but it's something along the lines of, you know, a sort of Socratic training for death that, you know, Socrates would say that philosophy would be. That maybe she views poetry as having a similar function, and that's why she says write it at the end, right? That's the thing you need to do, is that's what you're doing when you're writing poetry. You're losing. You're practicing losing. So in any event, I think those are two possible readings, at least, of the irony.
I like the first line of the, I think it's the second stanza. Lose something every day. It's just such a weird advice to give someone. I mean, it's clearly ironic there too. I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
When you lose something, by definition, it's you didn't want to lose it. Otherwise, is it really a loss?
Yeah, like it wasn't intentional.
Yeah. If I throw something in the river that I didn't want, that I wanted to throw there to get rid of it, have I lost it? I don't think so. That wouldn't be a correct way of describing what happened. The fact that she names the poem One Art, that she doesn't say the art of losing. Maybe the art of losing is, there's no such thing. You know, it's not something that you can get good at. By definition, losing is something that impacts us and that makes us feel finite, that makes us feel our weakness, that makes us feel that our art is limited in its power.
But maybe you do need to evoke, lose something to evoke a lot of emotion in you to create art. And this is like one art you can create, you know, like a poem out of such heightened emotions.
Okay, one other question. Why do people think that it's called One Art?
It means it's something that she picked apparently after... was reading up a little bit on her. After several attempts at naming it, she settled for that very concise title that is open to interpretation. It's much more interesting. She had named it first The Art of Losing, and then she decided to name it One Art.
This might be imposing too much onto the title, but I've often wondered whether it's implying that human endeavors in general are a sort of art of losing. You know, maybe it's almost like a St. Paul thing where St. Paul would say that, you know, you're supposed to pray in everything you do, if I'm remembering him correctly. And you know, somehow in all your activities, you're supposed to remember the finiteness of life. This might be a sort of Stoic kind of philosophy.
That's enough for the discussion of Elizabeth Bishop. Rob, please go ahead with your poem.
My poem is Darkness by Lord Byron. Just to give some background on Lord Byron, he was born in London, England in 1788. If there was ever the rock star or the Axl Rose or the Mick Jagger of his time, Lord Byron was that. He was a roustabout. He was, by all accounts, he was a heavy drinker. And he was also, he's had a lot of illegitimate children throughout England. We come to Darkness. Darkness is written as a blank verse. It's unrhymed lines with a metrical pattern. It reads like a Metallica song. It's very dark. It's very depressing. And it all depends about your perspective and how you digest it. And I will go ahead here and begin reading it. It's a long poem. Darkness by Lord Byron. I had a dream, which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless. And the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day, and men forgot their passions in the dread of this, their desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light. And they did live by watchfires and the thrones, the palaces of crowned kings, the huts, the habitations of all things which dwell were burnt for beacons, cities were consumed, and men were gathered around their blazing homes to look once more into each other's face. Happy were those who dwelt within the eye of the volcanoes and their mountain torch. A fearful hope was all the world contained. Forests were set on fire, but hour by hour they fell and faded, and the crackling trunks extinguished with a crash, and all was black. The brows of men, by the despairing light, wore an unearthly aspect, as by fits. The flashes fell upon them. Some lay down and hid their eyes and wept, and some did rest their chins upon their clenched hands and smiled, and others hurried to and fro and fed their funeral piles with fuel, and looked up with mad disquietude on the dull sky, the pall of a past world, and then again, with curses, cast them down upon the dust, and gnashed their teeth and howled. The wild birds shrieked and terrified, did flutter on the ground, and flap their useless wings. The wildest brutes came tame and tremulous, and vipers crawled and twined themselves among the multitude, hissing. But stingless, they were slain for food, and war, which for a moment was no more, did glut himself again. A meal was brought with blood, and each sate sullenly apart, gorging himself in gloom. No love was left. All earth was but one thought, and that was death, immediate and inglorious, and the pang of famine fed upon all entrails. Men died, and their bones were tombless as their flesh. The meager by the meager were devoured. Even dogs assailed their masters. All save one, and he was faithful to a course, and kept the birds and beasts and famished men at bay till hunger clung them, or the dropping dead blurred their lank jaws. Himself sought out no food, but with a piteous and perpetual moan and a quick, desolate cry, licking the hand, which answered not with a caress, he died. The crowd was famished by degrees, but two of an enormous city did survive, and they were enemies. They met beside the dying embers of an altar place, where had been heaped a mass of holy things for an unholy usage. They racked up and shivering scrapped with their cold skeleton hands. The feeble ashes and the feeble breath blew for a little life and made a flame, which was a mockery. Then they lifted up their eyes as it grew lighter and beheld each other's aspects, saw and shrieked and died. Even of their mutual hideousness they died, unknowing who he was upon whose brow famine had written fiend. The world was void. The populous and the powerful was a lump, seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless, a lump of death, a chaos of hard clay. The rivers, lakes, and oceans all stood still, and nothing stirred within their silent depths. Ships sailorless lay rotting on the sea, and their masts fell down piecemeal. As they dropped, they slept on the abyss without a surge. The waves were dead. The tides were in their grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe. That is Darkness by Lord Byron.
What I read was that there had been a volcanic eruption in 1816 in Indonesia that had been so massive that the overall temperature on the globe actually dropped by nearly 1 degree for a full year. And that there was actually, there was apparently, it was noticeable during the day, it was visibly darker for a long period of time, even in Europe. And that there were a lot of people who were saying that it was the beginning of the end of the world and that the darkness would soon, you know, encompass the earth. And that so there was this kind of general mood in Europe, which allegedly, I don't know how, I mean, I have not looked into it too deeply, but that would have been, according to some experts, the idea that sort of, or what gave by Lord Byron the idea of that poem. But the way I understood it was not necessarily against the Industrial Revolution, but maybe against modernity. The idea of becoming the masters of nature, which is basically the essence of the modern project. Byron shows, I think, very, very powerfully how ludicrous that project is. All that we call civilization depends on a series of very important conditions that we have absolutely no control over and that we will never have any control over. And still to this day, it has not changed.
Also, just think about like the what happened in the 1810s politically, right? Like in terms of the French Revolution finally kind of petering out. Enlightenment can just basically go away, right? We could just lose the Enlightenment, folks. You could just have pure darkness.
That's how I read it. You know, to make us be aware of the frailty of everything human. What we call civilization is extremely fragile. If we look at it from a cosmic perspective, it's ridiculously unimportant. It will pass. It will disappear. However grandiose our projects are, they are very, very unimportant. That's how I read it. It's definitely an order in that poem. You know, it's not chaos. There's a progression that he goes through. You know, first they burn everything. Now they live near the fire. There's no political order anymore. Civilization is gone. Then he talks about the different types of reactions that men have. Then he moves on to the other animals, the birds, the beast, the beast of prey, the snake. Then he says the war is interrupted, but then it starts again. But it's a war of a different genre. It's a war for food, for fire. There's no more love, only the thought of death. It sort of takes over and becomes all consuming for us. There's cannibalism. And then he talks about the only animal that has not become a wolf for the other animals. It's the dog that sort of protects the body of its dead master.
Of the corpse, of the corpse.
Yeah, the corpse. Yeah, that's it. Then the famine sort of kills most. The greater portion of mankind. There's a very few human beings left. At the end, there's only two left. They live in the same city, which is kind of interesting, and they are enemies. And so the way I understood it, their enemies become all human beings now are enemies. We're back in the state of nature, and we're back in the Hobbesian state of nature. There's darkness. Life is, how did Hobbes put it? Short? No. It's, what is it? Brutish?
Nasty, brutish,
yeah,
and
nasty,
short.
Nasty, brutish, and short. That's it. That's basically how life is after the disappearance of the sun. And then they die too. And then the world is empty.
Failure of everything, every system, every attempt at rebuilding is a failure. And then the very last line, she was the universe. So it's almost like this very, almost moral ending to it.
Yeah, almost peaceful.
Very peaceful.
We're done with that nonsense. You know, we're done with that nonsense.
Help. She was the universe. Why she? Yeah. Why was it a she?
That I don't know.
She would be presumably a life giver. I mean, you would think that that would be the association with having it be a she. But ironically, she's ending life.
But do you agree with me that in a way, it's sort of that ending is meant to convey a sense of
calmness?
Of calmness and peace.
Finality, yes.
Yeah, because cosmic peace, you know, it's not... It doesn't matter. It won't matter. Everything that we've done, that we've built is gone. What about What about the disappearance of love? That I liked. We are no longer capable. And he doesn't specify what kind of love. It can be the love of parents for his children, for their children. It's terrible. I don't love my brother anymore. I don't love my friend. I don't love my wife. I don't love my children. That has all gone.
It's love as in a general sense. He feels no love for anything.
We're alone. Each human being is left to himself or to herself.
And another book this reminded me of, especially the ending line, was, of course, the famous French philosopher writer Albert Camus with The Stranger, where at the end, the last paragraph of The Stranger, he's being prepared to be executed, and he said he opens his heart to the indifference of the universe. I think there's some similarities here between...
Isn't he looking at the starry night?
Looking at the starry night, and and basically says... Yeah. I don't care if you kill me. It doesn't matter because I'm alone. So what does it matter? However, I think that's kind of maybe the same philosophy spoken from that from The Stranger, the character there. Name escapes me at this time, but his same
Meursault,
philosophy.
Meursault.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, thank you. Stated throughout darkness. That might have been his own personal philosophy, that things are absurd. They don't matter. And this is how we're going to live our lives until the end. And he doesn't care at the end if he dies.
Camus says that the absurd is the result of the meeting of our demand for meaning and the indifference of the universe.
Illustrated by the myth of Sisyphus.
But it's true. The universe is a cold place, and we're
no love.
Well, that's in Crime and Misdemeanor of Woody Allen. You know that philosophy. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie. It's just a great movie.
It's a great movie.
He has this philosopher that he has recorded. You know who celebrates
right.
who celebrates the goodness of life and who ends up committing suicide.
Yeah.
and
I love
one of
all
the things
Woody
that
Allen's movies.
Me too. And one of the things that he says, that philosopher, is the universe is a cold, and it's the end of the movie. The universe is a cold place, and we are the only source of heat. We can sort of create a little bit of warmth by our capacity to love. But that's the only source of light and heat in that very cold place, because in itself, the universe is indifferent.
And
Byron is not far from saying the same thing, it seems to me.
Actually, I think it goes against the Woody Allen thing.
Go.
This is why. This is why he says, Woody Allen's like, we live in an indifferent universe, but we have the power through our, will to generate meaning or something like that. And what he's saying here is actually like a strange inversion of Wordsworth's famous phrase of nature never did betray the heart that loved her, right? Wordsworth would say, our morals really come from being able to be connected with nature and have a proper appreciation for like normal human life in nature, which might be true. I don't know, but it's almost like a strange inversion of that, right? Like if you turned off nature, everything good about human beings would stop mattering, right? Like the dogs, the last moment of love in the universe, the dog who is licking the hand of his dead master has no meaning whatsoever, right? Like even though the dog is trying to be like Woody Allen, right? And like try to generate meaning in this absurd situation, or it doesn't mean anything, right? Like in some sense, our lives as having meaning depends on a sort of physical kind of substrate that is not, that we really don't have any justification to have any faith in, as Wordsworth wanted to. But he's right in the sense that without the underlying nature, we're basically hopeless, right? And it could just turn south at any given moment, as illustrated by the mini ice age that happened in 1815 that Fabrice was pointing out.
Yeah, but It seems to me that for the Greeks, for example, Aristotle is perfectly at peace with the thought that his books would eventually be forgotten. He thought actually that that's exactly what he thought. He thought that the universe was sort of doing this sort of eternal motion of contraction and expansion, and that the individual named Aristotle had absolutely no importance cosmically, and he was okay with that. And you do not find the same modesty, cosmic modesty, in modern philosophy. It matters a great deal if we are going to be able to become masters of nature or not. Are we going to be able to guarantee our own survival as a species against meteorites, against the sun eventually running out of helium to, I don't know, you know, produce energy. Are we going to be able to, are we going to be where we need to be early enough to face those challenges? That's what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to develop, augment our power so as to be able to leave the earth when we will need to leave the earth, because eventually we will need to leave the earth if we want to survive as a species eternally.
When I go to sleep at night, I think of black holes at the end of the universe after all life's been has ended. For some reason, I like to think about those little tiny, those black holes as, you know, flinging around in the void. Like maybe one will pass by each other like every 10 million years. I don't know why. I find this a very comforting image. And I actually was reminded of it by the fact, by the line, "She was the universe," right? This observation that it's very peaceful at the end. And, you know, in a weird sense, like all, you know, whatever you're caring about from the day, well, it doesn't really matter in some sort of long-term sense, that, from the perspective of the ultimate end of
that helps to lose. That's the art of losing, you know, remember these things.
That's the art of losing.
I can see that. I've lost that thing that I loved a lot. It doesn't really matter, because in 5 billion years, the Andromeda galaxy will collapse with the Milky Way and we'll all be...
And the sun will get so big it'll swallow all the planets. Yeah. It's going to happen.
It's sort of a reassuring or calming thought.
Right.
This is all futile anyway.
It really is. On Spaceship Earth, we're going to crash.